was like, that was the hot term. Everyone was hiring prompt engineers. Now nobody's hiring prompt engineers. It is not even a role anymore.
This is probably the first time in history where we can say I wrote it, but I didn't read it. And really, like, yes, maybe you don't have to write as much code, but you have to read a lot of code.
When it comes to hiring, especially I would say on the startup side, but even in large enterprise as well, if that person is just kind of saying like, I know all this stuff and this is all hokey pokey and I'm not going to use it, that person's not going to get hired. This is not that, right? This is like today in Africa, in India, in the US, in people who are working, in students, everybody is using it and is enabling them to do something, to learn faster, to do a task faster, to, you know, to just, it's doing something. And that's why this urgency is there.
It is often compared to electricity, right? Like, you know, a multiplier of brain power, the way electricity was a multiplier of muscle power. But it is like, if electricity had been discovered and mastered when the grid was already there. So welcome to Knowledge Distillation, where we explore the rise of the AI analyst. I'm your host, Katrin Reibund, founder of Ask Why. And today we're tackling something every analyst is thinking or should be thinking about. How do you upskill during a hype cycle without betting on the wrong thing? In our previous episode with Mike Driscoll, we talked about the rise of the data scientist during the MPP hype. So for those of you who are too young to remember that, that was around 2010. The role was like all the rage at the time. And it still exists, but the question is in what shape? And which roles used to exist but don't anymore and have been replaced by the data scientist? So what actually stuck, what skills mattered, and when the hype settled? Because all hypes settle. That's a golden rule of hypes. And most importantly, what can we learn from other cycles as we navigate the rise of the AI analyst? And so who better to talk about the tech hype cycle than a Silicon Valley VC? And yes, Shomik, I shall call you a Silicon Valley VC because you are.
That's true. I live in Silicon Valley. That's true. Yeah.
And by that, I mean real life Silicon Valley, not the TV show. Although I have to say, I would really love to have Peter Gregory on the show. So Peter Gregory, if you're out there, find me on LinkedIn. I'll get you on the pod. So today I'm talking to Shomik Ghosh. Shomik, you have experience investing across the entire span of the tech life cycle. So from inception, which is the very beginning of a company, often before the company is even incorporated. In fact, you led Ask Why seed round. We were incorporated, though. Up to late stage in companies like Anaplan, Circle CI, Remitly, Area 1 Security. Some of those went through IPOs. So you really have a view across the entire span. You've seen multiple hype cycles from both sides as a growth stage investor backing companies and as a day zero investor working with founders before they sometimes even had a name for the company. So you also think about this stuff a lot. I mean, you think a lot in general, but you think about this stuff in particular a lot in your Software Snack Bites podcast and newsletter. So let's distill some knowledge. First, Shomik, what does a tech hype cycle look like to you? And specifically, how does this particular Gen AI cycle compare to what you've seen before? Walk us through like a technology wave you invested in from beginning to end. What did the hype cycle actually look like on the ground?
Yeah, well, Katrin, thank you for having me on, first of all. And two, also, it has been a lot of fun working with you from, when we were making the first hires and shipping the first product to see where it's come now and really, you know, how you are, I think, spearheading kind of this rise of the AI analysts and the tooling that will be needed, right, to enable that. But, I think the hype cycle is really funny, right? Because you see that Gartner chart all the time, right? Where it's like, you know, you start at the bottom, then you climb up and it's like, oh, things are great. Then you have the trough of disillusionment. And then, you know, things go back up, right? And so it's kind of funny because everything, like every one of those rhymes, it may not follow the exact same path, but it looks, it follows that curve at some point, right? And you know, like I think like one that was really interesting that I saw actually fairly recently was in the DevTools ecosystem, right? So you had this whole dynamic, especially with the rise of cloud, right? Where
just one thing, because our audience is mostly analysts, not software engineers. Could you like explain a little bit about DevTools and the rise of that? Like what is that really?
Yeah. So DevTools kind of started with basically if you were a software engineer, you need products that can help you do your job better, right? And now what you have is you have these cloud systems that you're spinning up. They require a number of microservices to be chained together to do certain tasks. And that is quite complex, right? The tooling you can use is you could use it from directly from the cloud providers, which would be AWS, GCP, Azure, and others. But, you know, those companies do not prioritize developer experience necessarily, right? Mm-hmm. They're prioritizing individual developer experience. I mean, they're prioritizing in many cases, like they're almost purposely complex because the Accentures of the world and the Deloittes get a lot of money helping large customers yes. implement these. Or they are, it's just not the top of mind thing for them because they are serving the largest companies in the world. And when you talk about an individual developer that's using the product, right, that is something that they just sometimes don't pay attention to. And that's where these companies step into the void, right? Mm-hmm. They would help with, you know, spinning up a continuous integration pipeline, right? They would, help you with testing. They would help you with all these different aspects so that when you're going to chain all these different complex microservices together to make an application run, this was a more seamless way to do it with like tools that you knew how to use. And so back in probably like, you know, 2016 going up till probably, you know, COVID times, you had this bring your own tools to work trend, right? Where basically individuals were bringing tools into work, especially software engineers, because people started to realize, wow, software engineers cost a lot of money to hire. If we can make them more efficient, then you know, that's a good investment. And so they were starting to bring these tools into work and people would pick up, you know, they'd use it in open source. Then they'd say, hey, we'd love to use it, but with security around it and so on, they'd pay for these developer tools. At 2020, 2021, that's when really we reached a peak because everyone's working from home. So then you just needed more and more of these tools. And, you know, you were having a software engineer in one group would use one tool and the next group would use a different tool. And you'd have like five products that were the same being used in one organization. Crazy, right? Yeah. And so that was kind of that peak, right? That's when everything was amazing. And we were talking dev tools of the future. And then we hit the trough of disillusionment, right? Budgets dried up. People started to consolidate to one tool or say like, you know what? We're just going to use a cloud provider's tool because go figure it out, right? Because that's just what we can afford to spend. And then ironically, you're actually now seeing it come up the other side, right? With AI, mm-hmm. Now you're starting to see this all over again, where it's like you might have someone that's using Copilot from Microsoft, right? Cursor. And maybe even using Windsurf or more likely like Cloud Code or something like that as well, because that's what they want to use. And that is happening right now because, again, it's bringing about efficiency. And so you see these curves keep on happening, but at the same time, we're back on that hype cycle again. And true adoption has always continued to pick up because these are still tried and true things that are happening. It's just they sometimes get overhyped and then they kind of trough and then they go back up again.
And when you think about, so one of those cycles, so let's say the dev tools, let's take the data scientist cycle and the dev tools cycle. In both cases, you have a technology evolution or change that fosters a new role, right? Ultimately, the bring your own tool to work, essentially, I mean, it's kind of a new role in a way, right? So you've got a new technology that's bringing about a new role. And a certain skill, specific skill or specific set of skills, get you hired. It gets you hired more than anything else, and it gets you hired at a sort of rate that is considerably different than the one that you would have had before, right? And so that peaks, and then other people catch up to you, that sort of normalizes. But then you still go back onto that cycle where, you know, it continues, but it continues differently. In DevOps, so in data, in the data analyst hype, the skill set was really being able to code analytics function with generally SQL or Python, depending. Mm-hmm. You know, R, there was a lot of mm-hmm. R to really depending, but you would have the religion of the database. There was the certain database that you would sort of like work with, and you would be either a SQL specialist, a Python specialist, an R specialist, and you would code your analytics, complex analytics functions on large amounts of data and do that effectively at that cost. And that was a skill that was obviously very valuable at the time and you know, and highly priced. In the DevOps peak, what was that skill? Like how did that work?
So ironically, like in the DevOps peak, where it came from was actually more around like could you understand how Kubernetes worked? And could you understand how to use tools to manage Kubernetes and containers that we're using deployed on Kubernetes, right? And so these sort of orchestration engines, right? These mm-hmm. abstractions of core systems that were, again, making it easier. And so if you knew these sort of tools that were these core abstractions that had become standard, right? That mm-hmm. That was really useful to you know, your career, your employment, your salaries, things like that. Now, you know, where that is today, right, would probably be, you know, again, like if we're using software engineers again, it's like the cursors of the world and stuff like that. But also, where did we just standardize upon? We just standardized upon MCP, Model mm-hmm. Context Protocol, for tool calling, right? So now all of a sudden, like if you are still stuck in the world of REST APIs, and that's how you use to call tools, like you're going to be in for a world of hurt, because everybody else is going to be using MCP yeah. from their model to from Claude or from, you know, ChatGPT or whatever, to call out to the tools that they want to use, and boom, they're just going to get going, right? And meanwhile, the rest of the tooling ecosystem is catching up. Microsoft is shipping MCP stuff, Google and AWS, right? Everybody's shipping it to go and make this easier. So if you do not embrace it, you will get left behind. And then what happens is, like, you're not even going to be on any part of the hype curve. You're going to be on the, you know, the train that is on the back, you know, that is getting left behind. And unfortunately, yeah. it's really hard to catch up.
And so there is these two aspects, right? The skill specific aspect and the tool specific aspect. And, you know, usage of a tool as a skill, right? But it really, there really is an aspect where you have to catch up with certain tools, and you have to develop certain skills. And so that's kind of what we want to look at is, for the AI analyst, what does that look like? And in a way, as analysts, we're lucky that we can look towards software engineers and get some understanding of how AI is disrupting a domain, because you have seen a number of startups at different stages have to adapt to the rise of the AI engineer already. Like it seems like, you know, that's already there and already almost gone, already just a given, right? And it's only really been 2 years, which is crazy, right? The term was coined 2 years ago. So what do you see both from for individual, basically, like for analysts, as being the skills and the type of tools that they should look at?
Yeah. So, you know, I think when this first started out, right, skills is very much similar to what the AI engineers had to go through, right? Was like, you just have to learn what AI is. And, you know, I'll plug your blog post. You have a bunch of them that are quite good on this topic, but I think, like, one of the things that you actually taught me about this was really, how code can be fairly deterministic, but then analytics can be that same output using these models becomes more probabilistic when you're using the models applied to that data, right? And that is quite challenging, because
the fact that as analysts we live in a world where there is no unit test for our output. The unit yeah. test is a human being accepting the result of your work. It's not very deterministic.
Yeah, and so that's a crazy thing, right? It's like a skill is just understanding, you know, kind of almost just one, first of all, what AI is, two, understanding like how it could help you in your work, right? But then three, also understanding where those shortcomings are. And so, for example, like there was a lot of text-to-SQL tools that came out, right?
Yes.
And people started going and running and using them. Pretty much none of them have reached core adoption because of the fact that, you know, at the time, and models have improved since, so I think it's going to start. But at the time, you know, the analysts were going and doing this, and then they were realizing like, oh, well, God, the output's kind of shitty, you know. Like,
yeah, we have an explicit rating, so you can go ahead and we can use normal language.
okay, but you know, it's so people would be have this weird thing that would happen where they'd look at this and they'd be like, wait, this tool is supposed to help me, right? It's supposed to help me do the job better, but instead, actually, it was like, you should just do the SQL yourself because you might actually be able to get to the answer because you understand the shape of the data, the schema, like all that sort of stuff. Now, I think that's actually where, you know, it's kind of funny because like that's still going to be true in this next era, right? Like the AI analyst still needs to understand all of that. But then now you need to start to weave in the tools that
this
you need to understand.
This is probably the first time
that,
in history,
right?
And I'm curious, where we can like, see if, what
you
it,
see
but I didn't
that.
Read it.
Well, you know,
and you
really,
said one
like,
thing that I think is,
yes,
for me, it's
you
like
don't have
number
to write
one
as much code,
skill
but you
for
have
the
to
AI
read a lot
analyst
of code.
And really
code
know
is a skill.
LLMs. Because you have to understand.
And that's one of the reasons why
I
did
the Foofy series.
What
is
the logic?
To help people grasp
what does it actually
very
do?
Complex
and
AI
is
ML
that
concepts
the logic that you want
in
to
a very,
adopt?
Very simple and hopefully entertaining
like,
manner. And also,
that's what
you know,
do as an analyst.
And so, you know, whether the query
video,
actually works or doesn't,
but
that
I
think
I,
is a problem
I
that
actually
was
mapped every feature
more
of the Foofy
to an AI ML feature
today
that with AI.
The queries will generally work.
So that allows me
to build
what
very
what
complex
you want to do. That's a
stories
story,
about,
right?
And
what
being
is
able to do that
reliably
when you poison
fast
your context, when you have attention
through,
dilution,
understand
how,
does it
you know,
do it,
forward,
yes,
path
works,
no,
what is it,
is
the result
function,
actually
so
the result of the logic
that
I want
understanding
to apply,
of what an LLM really is.
That is really, and that
is
a very different skill
from
writing code.
The difference
because
between
it happens at a very different rhythm.
I think increasingly
yeah, and, you
we
know,
are going
I think what you're saying is almost more of this. Like this is
all
the most.
LLMs, they're not going to be all
in order to be an AI, whatever analyst,
aren't.
Engineer,
and
knowing you know,
that is a,
just a,
is
even,
really a
even
fundamental
a person,
aspect.
Right, using
but more
it.
Importantly,
like, my mom uses
what
AI.
What you said about
right?
the SQL code generators.
It's kind of crazy
think,
that she does, right? Because she's quite older and she doesn't need to go and learn new things.
I was
going to
say, your mom actually really uses AI.
Yeah.
That's
she actually she loves it for cooking, right? Because she
oh,
can
amazing.
Just get things
yes.
that she can get. Yeah, and so, but you know, what I think is really interesting is it's like it's embracing this learning mindset, right? That's the biggest thing that we all need to do, right? I mean, because like it's very easy for all of us to get into our jobs and just say, okay, yeah, like you know, we can do these tools and stuff like that. But the AI engineers who are really really successful, it's not that they like even the young ones who are just starting off purely coding with cursor, they still understand the architecture, right? They still understand yeah. the components that are needed in the application. And same thing with the analyst, right? Like if I'm trying to be an AI analyst and I don't understand the shape of the data, that to me is like good luck. Like you can have the best yeah, tools in the world. You will not be able to even understand the output from those tools. You'll not be able to write the right prompts. You will not be able to understand what you should even do. And so there's still fundamental learning that you need to do. But then once you get past that stage, then if you don't adopt the tools, if you don't think about how the LLMs could work and stuff, you are just, that's where you're going to get left behind because the people who are doing it are going to get it done quicker. They're going to get promoted. They're going to be, they're going to be exploring more topics. They're going to be taking on more scope, right? Like all that's going to happen. And then, you know, you're going to be left behind. And so I think that's the weird thing. It's like, you still have to do the work. If anything, you might actually have to do more. You have to do more learning. I would say than
considerably
than
more learning.
Yeah.
And you know, so this is really what we want to talk about. So we have this aspect of the skills, for example, learning about LLMs, learning how to read code rather than write code, analyze the logic of code fast. Those are all skills. They're generic. And then you have the aspect of sort of latching onto certain tools, learning how to use certain specific tools because that's what gets you hired. That's what is sought after during the hype cycle, etc. That second aspect is
probably what is the most fragile to the hype and sort of lower and then sort of continuation, right? So that's probably where you need to be a little bit more choosy about what you're going to learn, because you don't have infinite time for learning. And if you think about those two different sort of terms, during a hype cycle, when it comes to managing changes and choosing exactly how to upskill and what to upskill and to position oneself on the job market, what pattern do you see that people miss when they're caught in the moment? Like, what do you see are big misses of people who just like get basically missed a wave?
Yeah. I mean, so the classic one, right, is 15, 20 years experience. I know how these systems work like the back of my hands, and doesn't actually embrace the learning mindset. And, you know, unfortunately, those people, like, they have such rich knowledge, right? And they could be superheroes, and they probably are actually right now currently superheroes, right? In terms of just the extent of stuff that they can do. When it comes to hiring, especially I would say on the startup side, but even in large enterprise as well, if that person is just kind of saying like, I know all this stuff and this is all hokey pokey and I'm not going to use it, it's that person's not going to get hired. I mean, I can tell you that in the boards that I'm on, the conversations that we have, I mean, I think you have even said, you've even told everyone that on the team that you need to be using AI tools. You need to be learning about stuff. You need to just be building with it. I don't, even if they don't use it in the actual.
We've been AI native from the beginning, right? We really radically made that choice from the very beginning. And we're a company where if you don't code, you get a side project. If you don't have a side project, you work on one of my nonprofits. They always need some help, but you are going to wrap your head around code generation, vibe coding, every possible flavor of using AI to generate code, to do analysis, and to understand how to prompt, because there is just no way out of that.
Yeah, and even the learnings that we got, right? Like, just from when the company first started to then, like, as we started to explore the models more, we started to be like, wow, you know, the hires that we thought we would do, we actually want them to look a little bit different. Because like originally we were like, oh, you know, we're going to hire senior this, senior that, right? And then now we're like, actually, you know, we kind of need them to be embracing this mindset instead. And that's actually more important than if they're senior, junior, middle, whatever. If they're embracing that, then that's what we need. And if they're not, then we don't need them.
Because like you cannot like give somebody curiosity or make somebody want to learn. That's just not possible. Especially in a startup, you just can't have the overhead of like pushing people. That's not possible. You need people to have a drive. I think that's probably true everywhere anyway, right? But like in a startup, it's particularly true. And so I see what you mean with the attitude, to bring to an interview, more specifically about the tools that you want that you're using. Thinking, so if I put myself into the shoes of an analyst today who is, maybe looking for a job or looking for a change of, change of direction, career, whatnot. I mean, the sort of, specialty, etc. Just wants to change jobs for whatever reason it is. AI is going to be part of what they're going to have to talk about during their interview. There is no question, right? I can't see a company that would not make that part of sort of the interview process. So currently, it's all about generic LLMs. It's all about knowing generic LLMs and maybe some MCP and maybe understanding the difference between ChatGPT and Claude when it comes to manipulating Excel, or generating code, which one is better at which. That's probably about the extent of it. But quite soon, it's going to be about which specific AI component of a database can you use well, which specific generic AI system can you use well. And there I can see why one would hesitate to learn too many of them, because there's quite a few, and you never know which ones are going to survive. My theory is that if you take the DevOps hype or the data science hype, let's say you became a specialist of Vertica, you know, analysis on Vertica. That was a little later than 2010, but, you know, whatever. Let's say that. Okay, well, maybe Vertica ended up being a little less successful at some point and not so much of a differentiator as a skill anymore. However, your ability to write on a columnar database with R or with SQL or with Python, that's something generic that you can take to another database very quickly. I suppose in the DevOps era, in the DevOps hype, you were a Kubernetes specialist. That's also translatable to another tool of the same type, right? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, if you're using Snowflake, right? And you're the best user at the world of Snowflake, that's amazing, right? And there's a lot of people that use Snowflake, but you may go to a company where they use Redshift, or they use BigQuery, or they use, you know, Azure's, whatever they call their thing. I don't actually know the Azure name for it. What's interesting is, like, kind of what you're talking about is, what are the key concepts of storage and compute and how you actually run queries, and what's the cost associated with running those queries, and, like, how do you do it most efficiently in terms of what schemas and things like that, right? Those are stuff that are all transferable between different tools, right? You may have to relearn a small aspect here or there, but in general, they're transferable. But then there's stuff that you will have to relearn completely, which is, like, how do you actually run the query, right? What is the cost associated with running that? What is the systems that, you know, how do you make connections? How do you output it to a dashboard? All these sort of things, right? Those are all going to be very specific to that tool. And that's where it's like, you almost don't want to go, you want to learn that, but you don't want that to be your whole worldview, right? Because if that's all you know, and you don't understand these other components, then it's not transferable. Then you are truly only the Salesforce administrator that only can do Salesforce and can't do HubSpot, right? Like, that's the challenge.
Yes. And I mean, you know, pre MPP, you had the Oracle admin. Yeah. I grew up in the age of the Oracle admin. You were not like hiring a database specialist. You were hiring an Oracle admin.
Yep. Remember that? I mean, speaking of hype cycles, like, I mean, DBAs are not even a term that's used anymore.
Exactly.
Right? Isn't that crazy? Like, that was the hottest and most sought after job, and extremely, extremely important, right? You got paid a ton. it's gone because technology moves so quickly. Now, the really good DBAs, they are still around and they're still doing exceptional jobs. It has changed because they've just changed with the tooling. But there's a lot of others who are still stuck, and the only jobs that they can get is, like, you know, in an Oracle shop where, you know, probably they're not innovating much, and you know, that's okay too. But that's you just get pigeonholed into that.
Well, that still exists, and if you don't want to or can somehow not, you know, work in a competitive environment, that's perfectly fine, right? But this is not the case today. I mean, I really do feel like this AI disruption is going faster and more across the board than what really anything that happened before. And ignoring it, it just feels like not a good idea.
Well, I think at least this is my view, and I'm curious to hear what you think about it. But, you know, for me, right, like, when I think about what modern AI, what this generation of AI is, right? We had platform shifts. Like, we had, like, hey, you were going to mobile and then you were going to the cloud and so on and so forth, right? But now I almost don't think of this as a platform shift so much as I think of it as an enablement shift. And why I make that distinction is, like, this is revolutionary. But also, because it's so revolutionary, the pace at which it's going to be adopted, since it's an enablement shift versus a platform shift, means that it's going to be adopted and permeate through the economy much, much faster. Because enablement means me and you and everyone else who's listening can get much better at our jobs today using the tool. What happened with cloud, for example, was you had to relearn systems, you had to port them over, you had to do all this work before you could get to that value. Here, you, in some cases, just by using, you know, ChatGPT, you can actually improve your own, you know, like when I research something, like my research is augmented immediately by ChatGPT, right? And this is something that I think is like, is the reason why that learning mindset and just moving quickly is so important, because that's why you're going to get left behind, is people are just being enabled much more quicker and they're picking up, they're using it, and then they're going on learning the next thing and doing the next thing. And that's why this cycle is so fast. But I'm curious, like, I don't know, do you agree with that?
I think it goes actually further than that. I think that it's an enablement across every layer of basically our existence. It's basically, you know, it's a sociological enabler, it's a cultural enabler. It really permeates every layer of our lives, whether people work or don't work. And it's one of these things that is creating such a profound change that if you do not embrace it, even just in your daily life, not even talking about work, right? Even just in your daily life, the world is going to feel very foreign to you very fast. In my opinion, it goes way beyond simply work. It really is existential.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I think it all goes in my mind to this concept of it is just happening at a pace and faster than we all think, because of the fact that we can all use it for various tasks. Like you said, even if my mom is not working, right? She's using it for personal tasks, she's using it for figuring out gifts. Like she's using it is just, but if you don't do it, like everybody else is doing it, and it will just change things, right? And so that's where I think, you know, and I don't know if that's the right term, but like I truly do think about this. Like when people think platform shifts, there's still this phase where you have to go through that adoption of that, right? When mobile came out, it was still a while before we got Uber and Airbnb and stuff like that, right? It was just like people were trying to figure out, well, do we design for iOS? Do we design for Android? How does that even work? Like all this sort of stuff, right? First before that, Palm Pilot, you know, like just BlackBerry, right? Like just so many things. This is not that. Right? This is like today in Africa, in India, in the US, in people who are working, in students, everybody is using it and is enabling them to do something, to learn faster, to do a task faster, to, you know, to just is doing something. And that's why this urgency is there.
It is often compared to electricity, right? Like, you know, a multiplier of brain power, the way electricity was a multiplier of muscle power. But it is like if electricity had been discovered and mastered when the grid was already there, right? Because this is what we already have the platform for this, right? The enablement the enablement is possible at this space because the diffusion platform is already there, right? So hence it can go at that pace. And I don't think that ever really happened before.
For any
revolution, really.
I think that's right. I don't think like even industrial revolution, when we're talking about, you know, manufacturing cars and stuff like that, still took time because you're changing fundamental systems versus here, even if you don't change the system, you can still go and use it. But then what's going to
happen? Something where the diffusion mechanism was universally already there, adopted with I wouldn't say nil because that's not true, but very, very low barrier to usage that just has never existed before.
Yeah. And I think that's where it's like, you know, these terms, right? AI analyst, AI engineer, they can almost feel a little bit scary, right? Because it's like, well, am I an AI engineer? Am I an AI analyst? Like I'm just an analyst. Like I'm just, you know, like that's what I am. And it's not meant to be scary in that way, right? It's meant to truly be like, the world is our burrito. Like
it's not meant to be scary at all. It's meant to be the opposite. It's meant to basically say it's not magic. It's not gonna replace you. The bots won't win, and AI analysts will. It's a tool. It's a tool, and you have to learn it. And you have to learn it. You have finite amounts of time. So you know, like, well, help try and help you figure out what to learn.
Yeah. Well, and have to also is like have to is. But it's like you almost want to learn it too, because
yes, the I mean, you know, not everybody wants to learn. I suppose I do.
No, but I mean it in this way. I mean, like, the reason why I think most people want to learn it is because even if they know how to do their analytics workflow exactly right every single time, if you could speed up a part of that process, wouldn't you want to do that? Like, I don't know a single person that loves, like, going through the same manual toil every single time, right? Like, if you were like, even one step of that process, I'm just saying, like, you know, generate me the SQL query, right? Like, that seems pretty cool. Like, I would want that. I'd just be like, okay, cool.
Yeah,
just
definitely take that. Right?
And then I'll just go through and continue doing it, right? Now, in terms of, you know, frankly, like, keeping up pace with the world, I think you're going to have to do more than that. But I just mean, like, everyone should want to adopt at least something in this chain because of the fact that's making your lives easier. And so, and that just means, like, we're going to have more time to do other stuff. Like, as a data analyst, the cool part is actually doing the analysis, yes, right? Like that's the fun part.
And so you've invested in, we talked about, like, you know, what people may miss. You invest in companies that went through major role transformations during technology shifts. When you watch these transformations, you know, talking to these founders, to these companies, being on those boards, hearing them talk about their clients and how their clients' roles shifted, how their company's roles shifted. From your investor point of view, what separated the people who successfully evolved with the technology from those who didn't?
Oh, it's a hard question because there's so many different aspects to it. I will say this, like, so in the modern, you know, there's this modern data stack, right?
Yes.
And talk about hype cycle or, you know, and, but that is
it's
real.
It's starting to be a little comical to say modern data stack at this point.
I know. But like, you know, you just saw Fivetran and dbt merge, mm-hmm, right? There's a lot of other players that have merged. Alteryx is putting itself up for sale. Like, there's a lot of stuff that's happening as a result of this. And I think what happened is it was this birth of, again, like, kind of a new platform, so to speak, of Snowflake and Databricks and Redshift, mm-hmm, and all these things that was, like, bringing this about, right? And everyone's getting very excited. Like, this is the new role. This is the new way to do it. And it's like, yes, it was for some of those large platforms. For some of the ecosystem around it, what happened was the budget went really, really fast, really, really high, because people were trying to get used to using these tools. And so, mm-hmm, anything that would make it easier would do it. But then what do those tools do? What do those platforms do? I mean, those platforms then turned around and looked at the ecosystem and was like, oh, okay, like, there's a bunch of data quality tools. Like, what if we just built some data quality internally as well? And then they started building the data quality internally. And, oh, ETL pipelines. Like, what if we did some of that internally? And, like, so on and so forth. And all of a sudden then what happened was when you got past that initial cycle and you, now you're on the trough, right? Mm-hmm. The budget froze up very quickly for stuff that wasn't, let's just use Snowflake as an example, like, wasn't Snowflake. Yes. And you know, maybe like a Fivetran had built so much density within the Snowflake ecosystem, or a DBT had built so much density that they were still getting a decent attach rate to the Snowflake spend. But a lot of others were left behind, right? And what's interesting is actually there's certain companies where, like, for example, you know, I have one company in mind, and actually I'll say the name, like, you know, Barry at Hex has done an exceptional job of, you know, building a notebook in that modern data stack era, riding the tailwinds of that, seeing AI, and then being like, how would AI change the concept of the notebook in that era, mm-hmm, and adapting to it and moving with it. And so now all of a sudden, like, he's now riding the next tailwind in AI, even though the budget from that era and the buyers and the tool requests and all that stuff has dried up. And so, you know, I give that as an example. It's just like, what I've seen the best people do is they don't glom on to just the here and now, right? Like, people want to use Snowflake better, so let's go and do that. They are thinking much more holistically about how do we make the role for this person better, not for a specific platform, right? And when you do that, and you're trying to really focus on the end user and focus on their role, that leads to you just understanding when AI happens, like, wow, this could enable that user a lot better. Versus saying, oh, well, can I make that change? Because that might break my Snowflake connector. And like, you know, and that's like most of my business. And so you see, it's a very different way. And so, yeah.
So to help our audience sort of see the forest from the tree a little bit in all this crop up of new tools that is coming, that is there and coming and is going to continue, obviously, you know, coming. You've written about the need to escape the Silicon Valley filter bubble, that everybody's like building the same thing and chasing the same trends. You know, you want to talk about that a little?
Yeah, well, first off, I would say, like, you know, it was really funny because when you started building Ask Why, like, you were an example of, like, you were not doing what was normal in Silicon Valley, right? You were going into a space that people were just like, oh, like, you know, like, there's already platforms there, people are going to use it, like, all that sort of stuff. And you're just like, oh yeah, no, this is where I want to focus, right? Meanwhile, the rest of Silicon Valley was seeing what was happening with CodeGen, and they were building more CodeGen and they were seeing what was happening with Clay and GTM enablement. And, well, they were building more, Clay competitors. And it was just like, you know, I almost sometimes think of this a little bit like, you see what's successful and then you immediately are just like, okay, well, I can take some share of that. And then that's going to make me successful. Right. And instead it's like, what made those companies successful was innovating ahead of where others were, or fast following. Right. And so Windsurf is a great example. Like, I think me and you talked about it a lot, right. Was like, wow, yeah. Like Kurtzer had come out and then Windsurf came out and we were both like, this is actually a pretty cool products, right? Because they were a fast follower that was thinking through it. But the long tail of others who raised hundreds of millions of dollars have all faded away into nothing.
Yes.
it's kind of crazy. They've all got, there's a bunch of them, right? And they were all extremely high caliber folks and hired amazing talent. It just was market dynamics that caused this to shift. And this is what I mean by like this Silicon Valley, just like doing the same thing, right? Like, the reason I even wrote the piece was actually kind of funny. It was like, at the time, people were saying like Google was going to lose an AI. It was just like, if you thought through first principles, they have TPUs, right? They have tensor processing units, which are their own native, essentially GPUs that they can use, right? Mm-hmm. They have all the AI talent in the world. But because they botched one model release, which was a big botch of the initial, I forget, what's it even called, Gemini back then, I don't remember, but like the first model that they released was not good. Everyone's like, oh, Perplexity's going to win and like, you know, and this and that. But that was causing this whole Silicon Valley ethos of like, yeah, that they're innovator's dilemma and they're going to lose and all this sort of stuff because everyone's read the same books and they think the same way and they know that.
Yes. Oh my God. Yes. That's so
true. You need to be able to step out. Like, Elon Musk is regardless of his, some of his other stuff, but like as an entrepreneur, he thinks from first principles, right? And I think like that's where you came in and you were thinking from first principles. If someone was like, I'm going to go and attack the marketing data analytics space, like at that point in time, I would have been like, you're crazy, right? But it wasn't actually crazy because there was stuff that you were actually to the learner's mindset, you were showing me stuff you were doing in ChatGPT, which I hadn't seen from anybody else, including the CodeGen people, right? The people who are doing CodeGen, who should be on the high end, were not doing the same level of work in ChatGPT that you were doing. And this was back when, you know, ChatGPT was still nascent. So yeah.
Very nascent. Yeah. Well, I kind of like got a little lucky. I invested in an AI company in 2021. So when it was like, you know, not very hype yet, this is way pre-ChatGPT. And so as a result, I ended up, it was also the pandemic and, you know, there was not much to do. So I ended up just like watching all these lecture on YouTube, MIT, Stanford lecture about AI and ML at the time, which some of the math was a little over my head. Most of it, you know, is not that complex. Like, you can at least in principle get it, and you can like understand what this is about and how it works. So when we got ChatGPT, my first thinking was patterns. And I mean, I struggled with patterns my entire analyst career. So I was like, oh, wouldn't it be amazing if it could do this, you know, passing things that we're doing in marketing? Because basically in marketing, you have to, when you create your data layer, you have to use the systems that exist. They only have the fields that exist, and everybody has to hijack those fields. And everybody hijacks those fields in different ways, which means you end up, structurally, you end up with a mess always. Even if you organize it, you end up with a mess. And putting that together is basically most of the use case of the digital analytics, sort of, you know, ETL, transformation, data preparation, all of that. And when I saw what it could do, I was like, wow, this is like another universe from everything I've done before in terms of ETL for non-technical user, helping data prep, helping do all of this easier. It's kind of one of the things that where I decided to do this again, because I was like, I just don't want to miss this era in technology development. It's too interesting.
But what, you know, what's crazy is like, it was still like when we saw what you were doing, and I forget what you had called it, like some sort of, there's a name that you had for it, but it was like the data bot that you were running, right? And you were like, look at the analysis that I can do with this and stuff. And I remember you were showing me that. I was like, whoa, like, you know, my mind was blown. I was like, I didn't know it could do that sort of analysis. And you were like figuring out the prompts and all that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And what's funny is now it's laughable thinking about what you were doing back then.
Oh, yeah.
Because, now it's like that. You know, it's the stuff we were thinking was so amazing. It's like, you know, it spits it out like with nothing, right? But I think what's really interesting is like, because you did that learning, it actually helped you when you start to see the models improve and stuff, because you could start to understand the capabilities more, right? You could be like, wow, okay, what is the step function that I can now do and that I can now enable? And that allowed AskWhy to start moving really rapidly forward, because you were already pushing it to say, okay, well, I already run these queries before. Now I rerun them. Wow, like it's doing this much faster. It's giving me more richer context. Like now, what else can I push the envelope on?
Yeah, I think you need to build in function of where you think the technology is going to be a few years from now. Very hard thing to do in the case of AI, but to a certain degree, it's somewhat possible. And yeah, for that you do need to have an understanding of how it actually works, right? But for an analyst sitting here in 2025, they're seeing this explosion of AI analyst jobs, job postings, and AI gets either tacked on to a job description, or it's in the title, or the job description is an amalgam of every possible skill on the planet that has anything to do with AI, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, and that's just the lack of maturity, you know, that will pass, right? But the question really is what to learn. And what to learn, they're being learned to prompt engineer, understand LLMs, get comfortable with AI, all of these sorts of things. In your opinion, which one of these skills will stick? I know, hard question. Look into the future, tell us. Well, you know, you do see very sort of like forward thinking technologies, you know, every day, obviously, and a lot of people, and you do see patterns, right? So
yeah,
it's not a question of like, you know, I mean, we're not going to hold it against you in 2 years if you're wrong in this podcast, but like, it would be really cool to get your gut feeling of what it is, what's actually likely to stick.
Yeah. So first off, I would say, like you mentioned prompt engineering, do you remember, like, even last year, there was like, that was the hot term. Everyone was hiring prompt engineers. And now nobody's hiring prompt engineers. It is not even a role anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think what's really interesting is like, we looked at a bunch of prompt engineering tools, at the time too. And that's where the patterns started to come into play, which like, if we think like a little bit further ahead, is first of all, one, like, are we going to be the ones doing the prompting? I don't know. Right. Like, but I think, now we can probably say we probably won't be the only ones doing the prompting. In fact, like an agent might prompt another agent to go do something, right? Mm-hmm. Based on maybe some high level instructions or specifications or things that we've given them, or even we pass them, we give them, you know, some data, and we give them context around what we were trying to achieve, and maybe it starts to go and do that, right? And so, so I think like really what's going to stick is, especially for the AI analyst, it's this fundamental understanding of, you know, what I think we would call like the shape of the data, like understanding what is in a revenue, file by category, right? Like why do SKU prices need to be in there? Why does geography need to be in there? Like just, that is still fundamentally something that is going to be helpful, because when you're starting to flesh out for the agent to go and do the work, you will then be able to just like draw better specifications for the agents, and your outcome, like, and what you're trying to engineer from that outcome is going to be much better because you understand that. And if you don't, that is going to be the case. And it's funny, cause like, you know, Jeff Bezos has that, like what things will not change. Right.
Yes.
And that is one thing that will not change. If you don't deeply understand still like your actual data, it will be very, very challenging, even if you have the best agents in the world, to be able to achieve the outcomes that you want. And I think tooling will help with that, right? Because they're going to help you do that analysis and understand it better. But like, that's still something that you're going to have to prompt to learn it, and then go and execute.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Would that be sort of close to your IDEA MACE framework that you use to evaluate founders?
Yeah, like I would say that's very similar, right? Where IDEA MACE really starts from this concept of, Balaji Srinivasan, I think he was the CTO of Coinbase. He started a couple different companies. He kind of coined this. He did some lectures on it. But really, it's like understanding if we're using a tree analogy, the roots, right, of the tree. And then as you start to go through and you start to test these different things, like how are the roots expanding? You know, how are they getting water? How do they cross each other? Things like that, right? You start to explore all those different nuances. And then you start to go like, okay, well now how does this form together to form a tree, right? How does the tree start to grow? Like all those sort of components, that's part of this idea maze. And again, if you just start it with there's leaves on the tree, and you don't understand those different components, you don't understand how the tree works. So if it starts to blow over in the wind, like you don't understand like, well, why is this happening? Right. Like you need to get that whole, that deep understanding from the roots. And that's the same thing with what we're talking about here, is like the skill that will not change is you still need to understand the roots. But if you do understand the roots, then the tooling will allow you to, you know, figure out everything else that much exponentially faster. By the way, I think also even to understand the roots, I think AI will help with that too. But I'm just saying like, that is where the core still needs to start, is like, you still need to understand the data. You still need to get to understand the components of it. And then you can even actually be able to interpret that data as well. Because if the agent starts to return you something back and like, it's giving you revenue by geo, but you have no sense for what that looks like, maybe it gave you something that was incorrect, right? Yeah. How would you know if you don't understand the data? And so that's where I think the key concept is.
I definitely agree with the fact that AI will allow you to do that exploration much better, because, I mean, we've never really had the ability to have long conversations about deeply technical or philosophical or whatever subjects with, you know, somebody who read all the books about it and never gets tired of answering your questions. I mean, you can run out of credits. That's another problem. But my best experience of that was building the Floofies framework and going through cycles and cycles of, okay, so the eyes are attention and the ears are the context window, But does that work for every case, every possible mechanism? Is that like crossing it in every possible way? If I had done that with my CTO, he would have quit. Guaranteed. So we talked about the hype cycle. We talked about past transformations. What are you seeing right now in the companies you're working with that are building tools in, you know, generally in the space, not necessarily in analytics, but generally in the space with AI? What are they building for? Like, what are they thinking of being the direction?
Yeah. So I would just say, like, the biggest change that has happened in general has been the rise of the lovables and like this and cursor and basically this whole vibe coding ethos, right? And when I say vibe coding, I don't just mean specifically coding for engineers. I mean, literally, like in Lovable, you can just say, like, you know, I want to create a calendar app that, you know, we could track what my family's doing or something, and it could go and do that, right? So this sort of, and even from ChatGPT, right? We type in a question, we get an answer. That is so fundamentally different than where we've been before, right? You typed in a question into Google, and you got articles that were really relevant for you to go and read and explore what those and explore like the learning that you were trying to get. Right now, you're getting the summarization of that in your you know, just directly in your hands. Mm-hmm. And that sort of shift to this like answer engine format, to this upfront value, is something that is changing for the builders in the ecosystem, right? Everyone now needs to build with that in mind. So there's an example of like there's a product where, you know, they're taking tons of complex data sources and they were, you know, delivering these outputs and really robust automations through that. But in the end, like what was happening was nobody was going and using the product because like what they actually wanted was first off to just be able to go and ask a question and have it give an answer. And then realize like, oh, wow, okay, this is, you know, I asked this thing, it gave a result. That result proved to be correct. Okay, great. Now let me go and start to see what I can do with it, right? So what I mean by that is like the initial work that we used to do in products has gone away. And now users do not have tolerance for that initial piece of work.
Yes, I can see that. So something that you wrote about incumbents kind of comes to my mind. You said, like, you wrote a piece about why incumbents love AI, and your thesis was that because AI is an enablement shift, it often benefits the incumbents who already have the data, the workflow, the relationships, etc. If that's true for companies, would you think that that's also true for people? So analysts as established companies with deep domain knowledge have a defensible mode. I really do think they do, right? If they upskill versus, you know, situations that I've seen recently where companies just eliminate an entire data team to replace them with a team built under a leader with, you know, some AI experience that is tasked with like bringing new people in. What do you think of that situation? Do you see that situation? And if yes, what do you think of that?
I think you see, you know, you see all sorts of different situations. So you definitely do see the one where they bring in, you know, the kind of so-called AI expert, which, by the way, like whenever that is like, is the thing that's happening, is usually not a good sign, because, you know, like the AI is everywhere, right? Like the experts actually could be the IC that's doing something versus like this manager who somehow has this like AI expertise. But regardless, I think that's a pretty terrible anti-pattern when people for example, just say like, I need a VPN or a CTO or a head of data or whatever that is an AI expert. Well, I mean, okay, like, what does an AI expert mean? I actually don't know. Like, I don't know either. does an AI expert mean like the lead researcher at Meta? Like, okay, well then good luck getting that person. And like, would that person know how to run your specific organization, your specific thing? So I think like really AI expertise comes in the form factor of like, it is just everywhere. Like we've talked about, is this enabler that is like pervasive throughout every single thing you're doing. So it is a mindset shift. it is not a so-called person or role shift or something like that. It is a mindset shift. You have to go and embrace these things. You have to learn them. You have to understand how they do it and what they could do for you and where their shortcomings are today and how those shortcomings, by the way, may not be there 6 months from now either, which is like the pace that it's going. Like, honestly, they go away pretty quickly. So I think that's like the most common thing I'm seeing is like the successful companies, they're not trying to hire for like the so-called AI expert. Mm-hmm. They're trying to hire much more for this, for more of like the curiosity, right? The curiosity component, the learning component, the stuff, and also making sure that you still have those fundamentals, right? Mm-hmm. And this is the biggest thing I think for coming out of like college or something like that, you know, it's like, how do you still have those fundamentals? How are you still learning those fundamentals while, you know, you're using Cursor? Because it's quite easy to not, you know, embrace those as well.
I think that makes total sense. And the way you demonstrate that curiosity and the way you demonstrate that mindset is by having projects of your own, knowledge of your own that you can showcase in your interviews. Like you have to have something to show for yourself about like how you use AI, what you do with AI. It's kind of like one of the things I want to develop on the podcast is get people to come in and talk about in their day-to-day, in their day as practitioners, as AI analysts, how do they actually use AI and just like have people talk about the cool stuff that they do? Because everybody's tinkering and everybody's kind of like, you know, discovering different things, and this era will never come back. So I kind of just want to hear from everybody about that. But specifically, so in the way that AI is transforming the role of the analyst, but really, I think most jobs, really. What I see is an evolution where increasingly we're going to get, I'll just talk about the, you know, analyst role, but I really do think it's applicable everywhere. We'll increasingly go towards situations where you'll have AI agents that are going to be increasingly autonomous, doing increasing large parts of work by themselves and having checkpoints with the human, and you'll be essentially running a virtual team of specialists and orchestrating and architecting them. Does that seem pertinent to you?
I think that's 100% where we're heading. I think we're gonna have a new terminology around this, right? I think we're gonna have a new language to describe what this is, but it's much more focused on the outcomes than and then kind of working backwards from that to then enable the agents to go and achieve those outcomes. And so, for example, if the outcome that you would like is sell more batteries, right, of this particular kind, well then, you know, it's like, okay, well now what do I need to know to figure out what campaigns did we run? What are the channels that we sold through? What are, you know, like all that stuff that goes to, again, you still need to understand the process, but you're going to be much more focused on like, hey, this agent is going to be focused specifically on trying to figure out the channels and segmenting those. And then maybe that then passes off to, you know, to another agent that is, you know, doing analysis in some way or whatever it is, right? And then maybe that one is calling out to MCP to you know, to get Salesforce data into the mix, and, you know, and so on and so forth. And you're going to have these, this is just going to happen, right? That's the cool part about it is like,
yeah,
you don't need to now be trying to figure out like, well, how do I build that API to Salesforce, or how do I query that will eventually not be something that you will need to worry about. Instead, though, you do need to worry about like, what is the outcome that I want? And then like, there are still going to be processes and ways to get that outcome done in a way that gets you the right answer, not necessarily the right answer, but the more correct answer for what you're looking for, right? And so what I mean by that is like, if the process is, you know, if the process skips over integrating Stripe data, mm-hmm. Well then, like, you've missed a large component of what could be adding value to that outcome that you're looking for, right? And so that's what I mean is like, there's all these little components that you will need to understand, and so that's where the orchestration part's really interesting, where you know, again, that base understanding is necessary to get to that. But like, I don't know, we need to come up with a new term, but we are going to be focused on outcomes. That's it.
Yes. Like, so would love to continue this conversation. I mean, every time we talked, I felt like, you know, you always came up with something that had a point of view that wasn't mine and was interesting. Like, I learned from every single one of our conversations. And so last question before we wrap up. If you were starting your career as a data analyst today, knowing everything you know about hype cycles, like you're a very wise, you know, college graduate, right? You know about the hype cycles. You have like knowledge of the world and technologies and all of that. What would you focus on learning?
Oh, well, so first off, I would say like the proliferation of podcasts is the biggest boon to learning you could ever ask for. Cool. And by the way, like the tools that you can now start to use around it. So Notebook LM is a godsend from Google, right? Google's Notebook LM. If I'm ever trying to learn something new, any single thing, for example, if I were to look at investing in Ask Why, for example, I would currently go into Notebook LM. I'd upload the website. I'd look at blog posts. I'd put your, Katrine's LinkedIn there. I'd put in the, you know, I'd put in the team's LinkedIn's. I'd put in, you know, maybe I'd put in a competitor's website. I'd put it, you know, like I just do everything I potentially could. Put it into the Notebook LM, write some prompts into that, choose the longest setting and just be like, boom, spit something out to me. That's where my research starts, right?
That's amazing.
It's completely different from before, right? That is where the research starts. And then I start to query all those sources. And I start to ask like, well, you know, because now I've got this podcast, right? That Notebook LM generated. I listen to it for, you know, call it an hour, 30 minutes, whatever. Mm-hmm. Now I've got a decent base of understanding to start with. Now I go and start to query. Okay, hey, you know, this is what I'm thinking about. These are some questions that came up. Let me start to ask that, right? And going through that. And I would just say like, as a college grad or even someone, not even a college grad, even someone who is senior and in their role, like not listening to the Dwarkesh podcast, which I know me and you are both big fans of, right? Like not listening to, you know, when Andre Karpathy came onto that, like I have listened to that 4 times and that is a, what, 2 hour long? Like that is 8 hours of my life that I've spent on
that
one podcast.
I've done that a few times for a bunch of episodes as well. Yeah.
Yeah, but like the amount each time it brings about a different question or a different thread or something like that. And then I go and explore that thread and it comes back to a learning, right? Mm-hmm. Or it comes back to a research paper or it comes back to something which is building my overall understanding, right? And that's what I would just say is like, it's not even for new grads. It's like for all of us. It's just like, do not have information anxiety or anything like that. Figure out how to distill it in the way that makes sense for you. For me, it's like this Notebook LM thing, right? Like I have anxiety over like, oh, there's so much content being created. Like, how do I know what's going on? It's like, okay, cool. Like whatever I think is relevant that comes through a Twitter feed, Katrine sends me, whoever sends me something, I'm just like, boom, Notebook LM. Like, tell me what's happening, you know? And then like
yes,
now
I did not know that. So when I send you stuff, it goes into Notebook LM. I had no idea. You see, I always learn something with you.
but you know, it's this sort of thing is like, is just, this is the most fun that we will have. It's also, I think it's also hard too, right? Because like you're having to use new muscles. You're having to just figure things out. But like the reward to it is just so cool because like you have to do less of the mundane stuff. Like it's the stuff
you
that we don't want to do.
Say you get to use new muscles. It's a privilege.
That's true. That's true.
It really is.
That's true. I would say that's true. And by the way, like, you know, for me, like, you know, I would encourage anyone who's listening to go through, the analytics versus engineering blog post that you've written. But for me, like, that was where I learned a ton about this difference between like, wow, okay, actually, you know, like why isn't Cursor just being used for analytics, right? And then when you start to break it apart, like, wow, like code is very deterministic, but analytics is not. and that to me was like, that's a,
I don't know why that wasn't in my brain before, right? But then finally, when you started to break apart, I was like, oh my God, this is really different. And now I get why.
We never had a really good reason to think about that before. We really didn't. Yes. So thank you so much, Shomi. This was really incredibly valuable. So shameless plug time. Where can people find you? Your podcast, Substack, your writings? Do you want people to contact you or do you not want people to contact you?
On Twitter, I'm at ShomikGhosh21. Anyone can follow me on Twitter. I'm also on LinkedIn, ShomikGhosh. If you want, you can reach out to Katrine to get in touch with me. But also, I would say, Software Snack Bites on, YouTube, on Substack, wherever you want to go. And I think right now I would just say I'm trying to be a sponge and learn everything. So like anybody who has interesting ideas, interesting articles, like things that you want to talk about, whatever, I'm open to all of it because this is some of the most fun that I've had in my career at this point. And so. And of course, I would say shameless plug, but I think the Ask Why product is exceptional. I think it really helps with a lot of this stuff because you've thought through even how to expose the data, for example. Like the data is something that you can still see. So when we talk about the shape of the data concept, it's not just like you're trusting the AI to do it, but you can go and see yourself and visualize it and understand it even just from the interface, let alone then having the templates, the workflows, the agents kind of doing everything that you would like to achieve. So I think bright future ahead. I think we are, it's coming. The AI engineering summit is a big thing. The AI analyst summit is going to be, it sometimes just takes a little bit of time, but it's going to be coming. And
it's going to be great.
Yeah.
And it's going to be called Knowledge Destination.
I love it. Yes, that's right.
So thank you so much, Shomik. And for our audience at Ask Why, we're building Prism around exactly this insight that the fundamentals survive every hype cycle. Context engineering, critical thinking, understanding what good analysis actually looks like. So you can check out what we're doing and try the Prism platform at askwhy.ai. And that's it for our third episode of Knowledge Distillation. If you're building your own AI analyst workflows using AI in any way, check out askwhy.ai. We're practicing what Shomik and I just preached. And please remember, bots execute workflows, AI analysts navigate ambiguity.
I love it. That's great.
Thanks to Tom Fuller for the editing magic on this episode. If you want to work with Tom, head to askwhy.ai and check out the show notes for his contact info.